You're listening to People Powered Radio, proudly supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. cbf.com.au.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Community Connections. I'm Alan Collier, and it's my pleasure to be with you. Let's introduce. I have with me Madeleine Pelser and Tegan Howard from Hutchison Legal. Welcome, ladies.
Hello, Alan.
Hi, Alan.
Now, we sent your way. I had momentarily forgotten this. A man has a family, which includes two kids and his wife. However, he has an affair with another woman. The woman gives birth to an illegitimate child. The father wants to know nothing about it, never met the child. Sometime later, his wife passes away and the man doesn't remarry at all. But he's by himself with his children. And the man is, well, he's never had anything to do with the illegitimate child. As the years pass on, the father actually died, and the child that was born out of wedlock decided they'd like to meet their family. And of course, at this time, the father had died. She claims she didn't particularly want any money. She wanted to meet the people. The family knew all about the child, and the child turns up, and they now want to know, well, they weren't included in the will, but how do they prove that they are their child? Because the current children from the husband and wife are saying, well, how do we know that you who you are saying you are? And I guess the other thing, and Madeleine, I know you're an expert on wills, apart from that, does that then say that you should name your children in your will? If the children from the, I'll say proper family, and that's probably not a good way to refer to it, if they were just mentioned in the will and only them, would that ruin any chances for the other one? Other than if he'd just said, I left my estate to my children. So first of all, how does this girl or woman prove that she is that child?
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack in that question. Yep. But if there's a dispute about paternity, then there would have to be a blood test done, a paternity test. But can be ordered by the court.
I was going to say, but the only person that can order that is a court, is a magistrate.
Ultimately, yeah. I think it would be the Supreme Court in a wills matter.
Right.
So the family could get a court order that she prove she's his child.
Yep.
And once that's established, then obviously it would. Did you say he had a will or he didn't have a will?
Yeah, he had a will.
Okay, but he left it to his named children.
I'm asking two questions.
Yes.
First of all, if those children were named,
yep,
or if he just said our children, so
okay,
where would that go?
So if it was my children,
yep,
and she could establish that she was his child, then that phrase would incorporate her.
Yep.
If
what
it was
not,
if he just said to my children so and so, so and so, and so and so,
yep,
and she wasn't mentioned,
yep,
then she does have the ability under the family provision legislation of the Administration and Probate Act,
yep,
to apply for further maintenance and provision than she was left. And then that would obviously further than zero. And that then a lot of factors would come into play.
Would she necessarily be treated as an equal or would she be treated as lesser?
Well, that's where all the factors come in. One of the biggest factors is need. So counterintuitively, if she was on the streets and had no form of income whatsoever, yeah, she'd actually have probably
a better chance
than the children who were millionaires,
yeah,
which is,
well, all right,
doesn't
so,
sit
but
well
what
with
about
a lot
if
of people.
They're all the same?
If they're all the same, then they'd look at the fact that he didn't know her, you know, and he didn't have a relationship with her, and she might be entitled to something, but not as much as the others. A lot of weight is given to the nature of the relationship.
What about if she, I mean, in this case she didn't, but what if she had wanted to get hold of the father, had tried, and the father said, no, I don't want to know you?
Yeah, well, still that would be taken into account because they're his wishes. So
right,
the court would look at all the factors. There's such a long list. The nature of the relationship, the character of the person, the contribution they made to the relationship or to the...
Well, there'd be none.
No, that's right. So so that's right. She's pretty low down on the scale.
Is she?
And the fact that he knew about her and left her out of his will, the court must look at at his will and take evidence from that as to what he wanted?
If he'd have, well, obviously in this case he didn't, because he didn't want to know the child.
No, that's right. So,
but if he had named her, then she'd have got an equal share.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, yeah, if he had wanted her to share and he'd put her in her will, his will, then she'd receive what he left her. But this legislation allows someone who wasn't provided for properly in their will, and someone for whom the testator had a moral duty to provide.
Yep.
That's the other thing. Query someone he didn't want to know and didn't take any notice of for his entire life,
yep,
or her entire life, how much of a moral duty did he have? So I think she'd be... I mean, he obviously did have some. If she was his child,
yep,
he had some duty to provide for her.
But not a big one.
But not necessarily the same as the others, I would say.
But even... Yeah. But if she was destitute, then...
Yeah.
Then she would really...
Yes, the court would look at her needs and the fact that maybe not acknowledging her contributed to her now being on the street.
Yep.
All those things. And if the...
Pretty big question, huh?
...children were wealthy... That he had left it to, that wouldn't go in their favour. So it may end up that she did get a certain share of his estate. And depending on the size of the estate too, there's a very long list of factors the court will look at.
All right, well, that's great.
You're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1.
Madeleine, VCAT, Guardianship and Administration, you'd like to talk about.
Yes, I just wanted to talk to listeners about this alternative system we have, alternative to the court system. It's more of a community court system. It's VCAT stands for Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal, and it's a more of an informal process which deals with lots of matters. There are five lists: administrative, civil, human rights, residential tenancies, and planning and environment. And the one Tegan and I deal most closely with is in the human rights list, and it's the guardianship and administration applications.
Can they make legal findings, like, or do they just hand out suggestions?
No, they are...
A legal body?
Binding. They are binding.
Yes.
And there's an appeal process. There is a process to award costs, but it's not done lightly. There's a strict regime for awarding costs. Otherwise, you pay your own costs. So it's a limited cost jurisdiction.
And the cost would be a lot less so than going to court, wouldn't it?
Much cheaper.
Yep.
And it is a jurisdiction you can attend on your own. You don't have to have legal representation.
Right.
In fact, technically, lawyers have to request permission to appear, but that's not denied.
Yep.
So, but it's much more approachable and manageable, and results are obtained a lot more quickly.
I was going to say quicker.
Yeah. And it's an informal process where people, like in the guardianship list, the represented person can be, before COVID, could be, it's in person, and that the tribunal member would take them aside, you know, behind the scenes and have a chat to them and that sort of thing, so that...
And
family members, family members are all listened to separately if necessary, and then they come back and the tribunal member will listen to them all. So everyone has a say, and it's more of a... It's particularly in tangled family situations. It's an opportunity for everybody to have a voice, and finally the represented person... I've never seen a decision where it wasn't made correctly for them, for their... What's the best... The best outcome for the represented person.
That's good. And is it quicker to get there than to court?
Much quicker, although there is a backlog at the moment because of COVID.
backlog everywhere.
But leaving that aside, and even then, VCAT will take notice of the urgency and will listen to any submissions that are made to get it on more quickly, and that happens quite easily.
So in VCAT, like when you get into court, you'll often hear the lawyers using all these big words, you know, and so does that not happen in VCAT? Is it more
It's much more informal. The tribunal...
More normal language than legal language.
That's right. The tribunal member asks who all the parties are. Once she knows, she or he knows who's there, she'll give each one the opportunity to speak, and they just speak as they wish. Mm. It usually gets to the nub of the problem.
Quicker,
yes. And there aren't so many rules of evidence and things that you can't say and can say and whatever. It's much less formal. But we're particularly involved where people who haven't made powers of attorney before they get dementia. And residential care facilities need some authority, formal authority to take people as residents, or a hospital might need to know who's going to pay the bills. So often applications are made to VCAT to appoint a guardian and administrator.
Oh, right. So the home themselves would apply in that case, would they? Or?
Their social worker can recommend that if it's a close family, they'll recommend that family members apply.
Yep.
Or if there's nobody available, they will apply.
Because, there are cases, aren't they, where they just, for some reason, there's no family.
That's right.
Yeah. Which is pretty sad.
And, much more so these days, they need formal authority to admit people. They can't just say, okay, fine.
Yeah.
They need some authorisation. So,
all right.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and we have our legal hour, as Grant just said. Hello, Grant, if you're listening. And we've got Madeline and Tegan with me. Tegan, we've had an easy run. You've just sat there listening to us. Tell us a bit about Annette's Law, which I believe is now passed into law.
That's right, Alan. Yes, it has. So passed last month in August. The technical term is the Crimes Legislation Amendment Bill 2022. But basically the law was championed by Stuart Schultz, who's the husband of Lynette, who was one of the four police officers who tragically died as part of the Eastern Freeway crash a couple of years ago. And it replaces the old law of outraging public decency. So the crime itself was as a result of the Porsche driver definitely didn't film what he was meant to film. So basically it's a new law. It carries a maximum of 5 years imprisonment, which is a very hefty punishment for something conduct that's grossly offensive to community standards of acceptable conduct. So the conduct must be public and it must be grossly offensive. They're the two elements of the new law, basically.
So is it going to be an easy law that's easy to police?
I think, there's aspects of it that are broad enough to capture that type of conduct, but it must be in public. It can't be a private act.
Right.
And it must be, objectively grossly offensive to what the public standards would
that
be.
That always worries me. So what what is gross?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
What does that mean?
No, that's right. Look, part of the second reading speech, they say that public indecency and offensive behaviour, offences capture a spectrum of behaviour. It's, to capture serious conducts of such magnitude that it meets the standard of an indictable offence. So an indictable offence is the most serious form of criminal offence.
Indictable offence normally carries a jail term, am I right?
It can, yeah, that's right. Yes, there's indictable and there's, summary offences.
Yep.
It's a high degree of offensiveness, basically, which is meant to capture a whole range of different things. So conduct that's merely offensive, shocking or insulting would not fall under that.
So like something
threshold.
Like people yelling and screaming at each other down the road, it's not going to be captured.
Doesn't sound like it, no, that's right. It goes beyond that. So the Eastern Freeway tragedy is an example of such conduct. And they draw upon that. Yeah, that's right. And so there's a fault element. So the first part of the element requires that to be found guilty of the offence, the accused must know or be reckless about whether their conduct occurs in a public place or is likely to be seen or heard by a person in a public place.
So it doesn't have to be seen by a whole lot of people, by just one or two people.
As long as it's in a public place, that's right.
Oh, right.
Exactly. And then there's a second part of the fault element, which requires that the accused must know, or a reasonable person would have known, that their conduct would likely grossly offend community standards of acceptable conduct. So they're part of the tests that would be prosecuted under it. Yeah.
Have there been any prosecutions?
I don't believe so far, but the outraging public decency former law was just very outdated, and I don't believe...
That would try to cover everything.
Yeah,
it?
Correct.
Like almost swearing down the street under that, and no one ever got prosecuted for that.
No, that is correct. Yeah, except for the driver of the Porsche. Oh. That's right. Yeah. So it abolishes the common law offence of outraging public decency. So it brings it to new standards.
All right. You're welcome back to Legal Hour. We're talking to Madeleine and Tegan from Hutchison Legal. The Robo-Debt Royal Commission is underway, and I don't know a lot about it, and probably a lot of listeners don't. So do you want to tell us a bit about it, please, Tegan?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It sounds something like from the future, a bit futuristic, Robo-Debt. But basically, it's the informal name given to a debt recovery program that started in 2015 that falsely accused members of the community of owing money to the government, so Centrelink debts and that kind of thing. So the actual Royal Commission started in August 2022, so it's well underway. And it also follows the class action lawsuit, which is in the process of being settled at the moment. And so the scheme, when it was in operation, unlawfully claimed almost $2 billion in payments from about 433,000 people. And class action lawsuit is in the process of being settled at the moment. And so the government has agreed to an out-of-court settlement of $1.2 billion in November 2020. So it's well underway, looking into why the scheme was started and the failures of the scheme. Justice Brennan Murphy, who was, you know, would have been one of the justices who decided the class action lawsuit, described the program as a shameful chapter in Australia's social security scheme. So it's pretty important. And so the Royal Commission will cover four things. So the establishment, design and implementation of the scheme, the handling of concerns raised about the scheme, the outcomes of the scheme, and measures needed to prevent similar failures in public administration. So it's well underway at the moment.
Well underway.
Yeah. Yep.
Could we talk about the superannuation legislation, please?
Absolutely.
The changes to it, they come into effect on the 1st of July, did they?
Yeah, so it's a constantly changing landscape of superannuation, but two significant changes that came in on the 1st of July. So prior to the 1st of July this year, it was possible to make non-concessional contributions, which is after-tax contributions of $110,000 per year, or if the bring-forward rule was used, $330,000 in 3 years, but you could make that in a one-off payment using the bring-forward rule. But the age limit for that contribution was 67, whereas and after that you had to pass a work test and prove that you'd worked a certain number of hours per fortnight. But the age limit for the work test has now risen to 74, so you can make those non-concessional contributions until you're 74 without proving that you've satisfied a work test. So that's an important change.
And the change you talk about now of letting the pensioners work, will that affect this at all? Because, I mean, some of those might be after 74 when they go to work. Will they still be allowed?
I think you still can't make super contributions after 75. So even if
they bring changes where the pensioners can work, right?
That's right, unless they change it again. But after 75, it's too late. But at least now you can keep topping up your super until you're 75 without satisfying a work test.
Well, fair enough.
So that's really good. And the other thing is the downsizer contribution, which is the ability to put $330,000 of your proceeds of sale from your residence, if you downsize, into super, as well as these non-concessional.
Oh, so you can do both.
Yeah, that's right. So that age limit used to be eligible to do that, you had to be 65, but now you can be 60. So if you downsize after 60, you can potentially put $660,000 into super.
Is that as a couple or a single?
Per person.
Per person?
Yep, per person. I'm pretty sure. Yes, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure it is per person. Yes. So because that's right, the cap is $1.6 million each of your supers.
Yep.
So, it would be per person.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah, it is. It's generous, and it's acknowledging the fact that the population's living longer and needs to provide for themselves longer.
And it takes the pressure off the governments too, doesn't it?
That's right. Yes.
Foster care is a way of offering children a safe, secure and nurturing place to stay when their family is unable to care for them. You can choose from several different types of care placements to suit your lifestyle. For more info on how to become a foster carer for Anglicare Victoria or to attend an information session, visit www.anglicarevic.org.au.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to Community Connections with our legal hour, which is just about finished. But if you've got any questions you want answered next month, I'll be back next month. Give us a send an email to info@yarravalleyfm.org.au and we'll put it to whoever comes in and we'll find out the definition. We can't talk about a particular case, but we can certainly talk about the law. Now, something we want you to have a look at, if you could please, is the responsible serving of alcohol. Now, we know that to be involved in a licensed restaurant or a hotel, and the person's asked two things. First of all, what's the responsibility of the person who's selling the alcohol a bar person, the person who works not necessarily behind the bar but works in the hotel themselves, and the third thing is what's the responsibility of the managers, that are they held responsible if a person under their employee does the wrong thing? I presume they are. And the other thing is the other question that this has come up with about is if we get a person that's at a licensed restaurant and they're allowed to get intoxicated and they go outside and they decide to walk home and walk down the middle of the road and get hit by a car, does the facility that supplied them that alcohol, are they part of, can the law come after them, particularly the police, and say, well, you let them go? So I guess that's another issue, that if you've got a person that's on your premises that you do allow to get molly to bunk, do you have to then make sure that they stay within your premises till they sober up, or what's the actual situation with the person down there? If you could just come back this way.
Yeah.
All right, now, let me just also, Madeleine, I believe your newsletter's out at the moment. Can you tell us just briefly what's in that?
Yeah, so if anyone would like to collect one of our newsletters, they'd be very welcome at 38 New Street. And we talk about the aged care costs, and that can be a bit of a landmine of information.
Oh, and they tell me it's going in and coming out. Yeah, they can get you both ways too.
That's right, that's right. Yeah. And there's different ways to pay and different options and so forth. Yeah. Then it's got a bit about the changes to superannuation that I talked about, but also organ donation and who has the final say, whether an executor can override an organ donor.
Could you add that to the RSA as well for someone to come back and actually give us a bit of a talk on organ donation as to who can...
Sorry, what's the RSA?
The question for next time,
which is
about that.
Yes, yes.
Well, could you, whoever's coming back, also give us a bit of a talk on that? Because unfortunately we're just about out of time.
No problem.
And that would be very interesting because I've often wondered who gets the final say, and particularly if two people say yes, and there might be four kids or two, and one says yes and one says no. How's that done? Ladies, unfortunately, I've got to go. I think that'll line us up pretty good for next time if we can find out about both the alcohol but also the donations. I think that could be a bit of a minefield.
It's an interesting one, yes.
All right,
thanks,
ladies,
for having us, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks for coming. I'm sorry that we're a bit late after getting away, but hey, we're here now. Thanks, ladies.